Welcome to the latest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I'm Josh Molina, filling in for our regular host, Phil Lanides, who's on vacation this week. And it's my pleasure, it's really my honor to have an opportunity today to talk to my friend, longtime friend, and a professional associate, but really just one of the premier MMA reporters, Eric Fontanez. Eric, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Josh. Thanks for having me, man.
Just a little bit of background. Eric used to work at, and I'm going to let you talk about yourself in a second here, Eric, but Eric used to work at a variety of publications, MMA Weekly among them. And when I was somebody who was starting out in MMA journalism, Eric gave me an opportunity, gave me a job, threw some work at me. One of those good guys of MMA journalism. And, I was never nearly, half as talented as Eric, because Eric is such a good reporter, great sources, great writer. And I was happy to sort of be in his space for a little while while we were, covering MMA and, UFC and Strikeforce, back when the sport was booming. And so I learned a lot from Eric. So I'm really excited to have you on the show. Eric, can you talk a little bit, remind people of, what you did and your role in MMA, and then we're going to dive in and talk Strikeforce.
Yeah, for sure. First of all, man, I appreciate you saying all that stuff. It means a lot to me that you, look at me in that kind of light. I don't want to toot my own horn, especially when it comes to this stuff. I just wanted to do good work and do it well. So when I hear somebody like you say something like that, I really just want to say thank you. I really appreciate that.
Well, you deserve it. As you know, there's so many MMA journalists, but you were legit. You did it well. You were well respected by the fighters, by the fans. I'm done. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. I started way back in the 2000s, probably about 2008, 2009. I'd honestly been laid off from a job in the insurance industry of all freaking places. but I was a big MMA fan, and I kind of considered myself a decent writer. I'd always been a good English student and, always wrote pretty good essays. So I thought I should take a stab at reporting. I wanted to write columns about MMA. I wanted to write features about MMA. So I tried to pimp myself out to all different types of places, and Bleacher Report gave me a shot. At the time, Bleacher Report was heavily dependent on Google and their keywords and being a search result for people looking for MMA stuff. And, the other side of it was they would crowdsource written material. So I put in my name. They said, we'll allow you to publish on our platform, but you'll do it for free. So, being that I was just getting into the business, I said, okay. And I wrote. I think I wrote at least one article a day about something. If there was something on my mind, I would put it on my laptop. And I had a Twitter account where I would, speak most of my mind. I would just give my two cents on the sport at the time. And it ended up working. Bleacher Report, of course, was an emerging platform. They were doing all types of traffic. And I would naturally started to get more and more recognition just by publishing there. Eventually, they gave me an opportunity with a contract. So I was finally being compensated for what I was doing. And through that, I met all types of people within the industry. I started attending fights as press, met fighters, met managers and trainers and other journalists, a lot of people that I networked with. And that kind of led the way to me joining up with MMA Weekly. And Ken Pishna and Scott Peterson and Jeff Kane were all the guys that I worked with on a regular basis to try to produce hard news when it came to MMA. So we would try to dig at sources and try to get information so that we could report on all the happenings of the sport. I think we did a pretty good job for a few years. You know, I think the PR branches of the organizations realized that there was more value for them to report their news directly, especially considering the emergence of social media at the time. So communicating with sources became more and more difficult, and trying to get breaking news through conversation became more and more difficult. It seemed like at a point where these fighters and managers and trainers and everybody just did not want to say anything as a means of avoiding retribution from the organizations.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, it was far more the UFC saying that than Strikeforce.
Right.
The UFC just really wanted to keep a cap on everything. And my view was always, any news is good news. Like, I don't care what it was, especially if it was like a fight announcement. Like, if I broke the news about a main event for a pay-per-view, that would piss off everybody in the UFC.
Right.
And, you know, it would be right. And they would, you know, go on with the fight and everybody would get paid and all that, but they wanted to break their own news. I mean, I don't know if there's some sort of thing with like investors or advertisers that they were working with that this kind of messed with for them. If it did, you know, sorry, not sorry. My job was to report the news and I reported it when I got it.
Right.
So, you know, and I did that for a number of years, all the way up through, I want to say 2019 was the last time I really, or 2018, around then was the last time I really gave a push into reporting on mixed martial arts. And, you know, I left the sport at that time, happy with my decision, and I continue to be happy with the decision just because I cannot continue to try to grind at sources to get, you know, news that's going to break and not be read by a number of people. It just seems like, I don't know how it is nowadays. I don't know if the UFC is still, you know, putting a clamp on the news reporting.
Yeah.
But, you know, given the collapse of the MMA section of the Atlantic, or I'm sorry, not the Atlantic, the Athletic, you know, I just imagine that true, genuine journalism is still struggling, specifically in mixed martial arts, just because there are so many people behind the scenes that control so much of it that they have an effect on the journalism industry. So that's kind of why I stepped away. One of the reasons I stepped away, and I'm happy with it, and I'm at peace with it. But yeah, now it's just not even something I think about much unless I'm talking on it, you know, like a podcast.
Yeah. You know, I don't think too much has changed. I think that you still see the same journalists, the same publications getting a certain kind of access to the fighters that other sort of more traditional news outlets won't get. And one of the things that, you know, Phil and I really liked about Strikeforce was the authenticity that it brought back, you know, in 2006, when it sort of emerged into, you know, this sort of the Scott Coker sort of, you know, San Jose, Frank Shamrock, CBS, Showtime, like this era where it, you know, transitioned from, you know, its origins as a kickboxing organization into something else. And it just felt more traditional, more real, more of a focus on the fighters. There was less control that was being exerted over the MMA journalism industry. Can you talk, Eric, about what you recall about Strikeforce and some of your memories, some of the highlights? And, you know, if you want to start at the beginning, or, you know, just what do you think about when you think about Strikeforce and sort of its emergence as a, let's be real, it was, you know, never a really one-on-one strong direct competitor to the UFC, but it definitely made some noise, and it definitely UFC was aware of them and they were very conscious of their product. So what do you think about when you think about Strikeforce and your memories of the company?
Well, to touch specifically on a competition to the UFC, I absolutely believe that Strikeforce was a direct threat to the UFC. Uh-huh. And the reason why is because of all that noise they were making. Mm-hmm. Like they had fighters leaving the UFC to go to Strikeforce. They had, you know, Strikeforce had the financial backing reportedly to pay fighters. And guys never really complained about that. You know, they were going, getting things done. And I think the UFC recognized it, which is why they made their bid to purchase Strikeforce. You know, of course, I think there was like there's a part of that where Strikeforce might have been bleeding money, but you know, I think the UFC recognized that Strikeforce was a competitor that took away attention from the UFC. And if we've learned anything about Dana White and, you know, Fertitta's, it's like they don't like to share the sandbox. Yeah, and right. They were very much about me, and the attention driven on them. And if any of that was being taken away, they were going to be pissed and they were going to try to do something about that. So that was Strikeforce. Strikeforce came through. They had guys like Dan Henderson going over there. And you know, he'd be walking around with pride belts and all that stuff. Like they co-branded regularly, which I loved. Like so many years in the UFC, they refused to co-brand with other promotions, which ultimately led to us never seeing Fedor Emelianenko in the UFC. You know, but we got Fedor, you know, post prime Fedor at that, but still Fedor in the Strikeforce cage, mm-hmm. which I loved. Like his fights in Japan were absolutely legendary. And when I started seeing him in the US finally, like it was just unbelievable and great to me. And Coker, you know, Scott Coker was a good dude to me. Like, I don't know what kind of relationship he had with other reporters or the people within the industry, but every time I communicated with Scott Coker, I got good information and had good talks, and, you know, stuff was on the record, off the record, and he was always open to communication. Whereas that was not the same with the UFC. So covering Strikeforce, it was actually easier for me. Yeah, it was a lot easier. Trust me, it didn't get as many views as, say, you know, Brock Lesnar doing his UFC heavyweight championship run in the UFC, but it still gave me an opportunity to report on things happening that made a difference in the sport. And Strikeforce provided me that opportunity. Scott Coker provided me that opportunity. So I appreciated them for being the organization that they were from a reporting aspect and from an entertainment aspect, man. I sat cage side for KJ Nunes and Gilbert Melendez.
Nick Diaz?
No, Nick Diaz. Yeah. You know, I sat cage side for all those guys.
Yeah.
And you know, it was fun to watch. Like the fights were entertaining. Nick Diaz was still doing great things. Like it was an absolute joy to watch that kind of stuff. And then the post-fight stuff was easily accessible. Like they always, the PR department, kudos to them. They always work with reporters to try to ensure they get their message out and we get the message delivered. It was great stuff. It was a good organization. When the UFC bought Strikeforce, I knew it was the beginning of the end for them.
Right.
Like they were going to dissolve it. They didn't want any other brand getting any kind of recognition within the MMA space. Like I remember like the classic line, the classic quote from Dana White, it's going to be business as usual. And it was far from that, as we've all learned. It was not business as usual. Strikeforce existed for a little while after that, but then they dissolved everything. And you know, it became the sole focus on the UFC again. And it was like, God.
Yeah. You know, everything you said about Scott Coker is true. You know, he's been a guest on this podcast, and he was always accessible to journalists. There's no pretension there. You didn't have to act a certain way to talk to him. And then you were at cage side for some of these fights. And you know, when we talk about Strikeforce's impact, I think of a guy like Daniel Cormier. Okay, so maybe we can talk about him a little bit. Daniel Cormier is a guy who got his start in Strikeforce and then became like one of the best MMA fighters of all time when he eventually, you know, won the Strikeforce light heavyweight championship, heavyweight championship. Mm-hmm. What do you recall? Like Daniel Cormier, you're watching this guy, you know, do you think this guy's going to be one of the best? What do you remember about him and these other fighters who got their start? Tyron Woodley, for example, in Strikeforce. Ronda Rousey, you know, in Strikeforce. Misha Tate, these people mm-hmm. who would become world champions in the UFC. What do you
Gegard Mousasi, Keith Jardine, like mm-hmm. all those guys. Yeah, like the impact that these fighters had on mixed martial arts was recognized by the UFC. Mm-hmm. Okay. Like they knew that Strikeforce was doing great cards, entertaining cards. They didn't have to throw in, you know, a death metal band in the middle of their shows like, Affliction did.
Right.
It was great stuff, you know, and Cormier, like to his credit, you know, carried, I honestly feel like he carried that heavyweight division. Mm-hmm. We could talk all day about Alistair Overeem and how like massive and fit, what a physical specimen he was. But of course, you know, he was taking horse steroids in order to look like he did. Yeah. But Cormier really like did great things. Like he was a wrestler who, you know, came into mixed martial arts and focused on his striking to get better at that. And he had a punch behind him, man. Like he really threw power and like grinded dudes. Like he wasn't like other fighters. We were talking about Tyron Woodley, off the pod and like as great as I feel Tyron Woodley is, like I don't think his striking was ever at the point where it was just like, man, Tyron Woodley's going to knock you out every single time. But you always had that concern with Daniel Cormier. Mm-hmm. Daniel was, you know, a great, great fighter. You know, I think, you know, when he finally went to the UFC and was doing things there, like he was entertaining there too. But like he was one of the reasons Strikeforce was a threat to the UFC. And look at him now, you know, he's doing, you know, play by play and you know, being the center of memes for for the UFC. Like he is a legitimate like candidate for the Mount Rushmore of mixed martial arts now, you know. And it all started in Strikeforce. Like it was great stuff. Nick Diaz, you know, was fighting Paul Daly and knocking him out, and Paul Daly was known as the striker, right?
Yeah.
So, and that was like just one round of fights. That was one round.
Yeah.
And at the very end of the round, he puts his hands on him, and Daly's arms just go flailing, and he falls down, and they call the fight. And like that was exciting, man. Like that was good stuff. That was the fight that I was trying to think of, is Diaz and Daly.
That was a good round, yeah.
Oh God, it was fun, man. It was so fun. I think back to Strikeforce and like I got nothing but smiles out of it. Like it was, from a fan perspective, it was entertaining. From a professional's perspective, they were easy to work with. So like in my eyes, like they were the best organization MMA has seen in this century. Mm-hmm. Like all kudos to the UFC and their marketing machine for getting as much attention as they do. Fine, whatever. Strikeforce was where it was at, man. Strikeforce and Pride was where it was at. And that no one will be able to change my mind about that.
Yeah, no, without a doubt, you know, Luke Rockhold, you mentioned Gilbert Melendez. So many of these individuals would eventually become UFC champions, even if they didn't. They they were great, you know, but long before they ever entered the UFC. You know, recently Misha Tate fought in the UFC. She sort of made a comeback. She lost a decision. And, you know, as we record this, Amanda Nunes, you know, fought in the UFC and, you know, lost to Juliana Pena. You know, Amanda Nunes had a fight in Strikeforce, you know, long before she was, you know, the Amanda Nunes we know. Can we talk about women's MMA and Ronda? And I know you've probably, you know, we're like many of us and probably got, you know, snubbed by Ronda in the MMA media. But can you talk a little bit? No, okay, maybe you had access to her. Okay,
so I did.
Can you talk a little bit about women's MMA? I mean, this is a time when Dana White is like, I will never promote women's MMA. Right. It'll never happen. Right. And then all of a sudden we see these pioneers like, you know, Marlos Conan and Misha Tate and Gina Carano and Cyborg and then Ronda. And all of a sudden, you know, he starts to take notice. Can you talk about women's MMA and Strikeforce and its impact in that part of the sport?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head, man. Like Dana, he crapped on women's MMA saying that he would absolutely not do it. Like for whatever his reasons were, he never really explained why or genuinely explained why. But realistically, women's MMA was on a great rise in the early 2010s. And people like Ronda Rousey, you know, I know everybody talks about how she, you know, didn't have any striking, but you know what? Look, again, neither did Woodley, you know, like, but Woodley was a champ, you know, and I think Rousey, on top of everything, on top of her judo skill and her ability to grapple and so on, she was great on the mic. You know, she knew how to sell a fight. This is why she had success in the WWE. Like she transitioned over there and was immediately a hit. Like she knows how to talk on the mic. She knew how to sell fights. She knew how to talk shit. She had this aura about her that, you know, I'm here to mess you up. Like her Rousey stare that she had was like she looks pissed. and you know, people were into that, you know, and you know, I was one of the lucky few that had direct access to Rousey. I had her phone number and everything. And you know, I'd communicate with her every so often. Like I remember the first time I met her at a gym in the San Fernando Valley in Southern California. I met her there to talk about, you know, her transition and like an HBO special that she was doing and, you know, all the things. So I had maybe 20 minutes between workouts with her, but I stayed for the workouts. And this woman was putting in work. It's not like she was just like some pretty blonde that came off the street and immediately sold things to the MMA community. No, she was legit. You know, she was a judoka in the Olympics. She, you know, was a physical specimen. Like she had the package. She had all the potential to do great things. I mean, ultimately it ended with her getting served hands and feet courtesy of Holly Holm.
Yeah.
But like she was good. She was great. And she brought attention. Like she was like the second wave of great attention that women's MMA had, and it happened in Strikeforce. The first wave, Carano and Cyborg.
Yeah.
Carano and Cyborg was like hype because Cyborg was exactly that, a cyborg, and she just would destroy people. And then Carano was a great striker and, you know, like easy on the eyes. So like that would get a lot of attention. You know, and not to take, like, I don't want to emphasize on Carano's beauty or anything like that. She is very pretty and beautiful, but she was legit a fighter. And I loved watching her do her thing. Like she had Muay Thai training that was beyond, you know, anything I could ever do. And she did it well. And she really rocked some people.
Yeah.
I was actually sad not to see her debut in the UFC. I know they had talked about it for a long time. Dana White and Carano's people were talking about it for a while, but they just never came to an agreement.
Right.
But, you know, she had her stint on The Mandalorian, so I think she's doing all right.
Yeah.
But
she was tough. like if you watch that fight with Cyborg, which, you know, I think it ended right before the round ended. I mean, man, she took a beating. She was tough. She was so tough, though.
There's a photo, and I forget who the photographer was, but there's a photo of Carano receiving a right hook from Cyborg, and the picture is just like immediately as the fist hits her face, and you could see Carano just like cringing in pain. And then in the blurry background, you see Cyborg's eyes, and she looks like a great white shark, like about to attack a piece of meat. Like, yeah, that's what that reminded me of. And that was, you know, and that's women's MMA, you know, like it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't being sold on sex, which a lot of women's sports had to deal with back then. You know, it was being sold on the fact that these girls were freaking great at fighting. Yeah. And it was incredible to see. It was incredible to watch. Rousey was, she was a great conversation. She knew how to carry herself. She knew the right things to say. She was very open to communication. And so, as I said, with Strikeforce, she made it easier for me to do my job, and that I'd always appreciate. I mean, after a few years, she started to get all types of attention in the wrong way, and, you know, like everybody was poo-pooing on her, and like she needed to disconnect from everyone, which I totally understand, because like now I'm in that space where I'm just like, I need to disconnect from the MMA community altogether because I cannot deal. It just was too much. And so I can't blame her for the trajectory of her career and the decisions she made. So this woman came in, showed off her incredible talent as a grappler, got to the top of the sport, then transitioned into real fighting in the WWE, and was a star there.
I sent some sarcasm, Eric. I'm not going to forget. I will not forgive you for that, but continue.
I was trying to give you the props. Like, hey, you want to do real fighting? WWE is where it's at.
Where the money is, for that, sure.
Well, yeah. And, you know, she got paid.
Yeah.
She got paid. And, you know, now, you know, she doesn't need the WWE. She doesn't need the UFC or MMA. She's good being a mom at home, married to Travis Brown, and streaming video games all day. So, and good for her. She deserves it. Like, she was something to this sport. And honestly, I feel like the sport poo-pooed on her enough to where, like, it was just uncalled for. And we see that so much in this game. People are put into the system and then they're spat out the other end. Rousey was one of them. And, you know, the common thing we see here is that it all, like, most fighters towards the end of their time are always talking about their struggle with Dana White. And it's, where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, that's all I'm saying. Dana White is a problem. Like, he wants to be the brand of the UFC, whereas the fighters should be the brand of the UFC. I don't care about Dana White.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm an MMA fan, I want to see, you know, I want to see fighters who are actually great do great things and not listen to how Dana White thinks they're great. I just want to see it.
Yeah. You know, and you mentioned, you know, Ronda Rousey, and it's just a sad fact of our society with social media. The bigger you get, the more haters come out. And particularly when you're a woman and you're in a sport that historically has been, you know, dominated by men, and you're trying to fight for your respect at the table. And then the first time you lose, these people who've never really, you know, understood the position that she was in, they all of a sudden they say, oh, look, she was never that good. She was never that great, you know, and they don't realize, like, everybody loses, you know, nobody's going to go their whole career without, you know, losing a fight or getting knocked out if you're a competitor, because you keep going until you lose. It's just the way it is. You almost have to lose. You almost have to, because you push yourself until you just can't go anymore. And, you know, she certainly had that impact
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, it's great to hear you had a good sort of a professional relationship with her, because, you know, she gets a lot of bad, you know, attention for, you know, sort of turning on your, on the journalists or the media or whoever crosses her. You know?
Let's keep it real.
Yeah.
There are reporters in this game who will backstab you just as quickly as the organization will backstab you. Yeah. And that needs to be said. I will always pride myself in being a reporter, a journalist, but I knew there were people in this game who were shady. Mm-hmm. Bottom line, like, there are people in this game who still are shady. It doesn't change. And I don't look at Rousey's perception of the media as something that's unfounded. Mm-hmm. She is likely done wrong by some of the more popular journalists, and it's okay for her to be upset, and vice versa. Like, if there are reporters who were done wrong by fighters, like me being one of them, like I've had fighters who called me after I wrote a story about them and say, WTF, Eric. And I'm like, what? And they're like, you weren't supposed to print that. And I'm like, why wasn't I supposed to print that? I called you for an interview. Well, it was off the record. Well, what do you mean it was off the record? At no point did you say it was off the record. Like, you know, and then they get pissy with me, and then I become public enemy number one. So like, there are people in this game who are just, they have no accountability. They just want the acclaim, which happens in all aspects of every sport, in every business, every industry. But I'll say this, MMA has some of the shadiest people I've ever come across in my lifetime. In my 40 years of life, MMA has been like, yo, you guys got some therapy that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, let's talk about Rhonda and Misha Tate for a second. Sure. In recapping these shows, Phil and I are approaching sort of the Ronda Rousey, you know, era, and Misha Tate and all of that. What do you recall about that feud in terms of how it helped women's MMA? You talked about sort of the first wave with Carano and Cyborg, and the fact that everybody was sort of like, whoa, these are good fighters, you know, and this happened. And then we sort of see Ronda Rousey come along and just start tapping fighters out in seconds, right? She's just like incredible. And then she's got this grudge match with Misha Tate. And what do you recall about those fights and what Misha was able to show, what Rhonda was able to show, and sort of the high level, you know, sort of submission that Rhonda was able to bring to the sport? What do you recall about their rivalry?
I felt like it was genuine, hatred. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time people sell, like fighters sell this like bad blood that they have for each other. And, you know, it's all part of the marketing that is associated with the lead up to these fights. Mm-hmm. It's like, I honestly felt like Misha and Rhonda just did not like each other. Right. They're not nice to each other. I know, like, Misha tried to play the role of like, no, I'm not going to listen to the bad blood. Like, it's not like that. But then she'd say something else and like totally add fuel to the fire. And Rousey just like, you know, wanted to punt, looked like she wanted to punch her in the face every time they looked at each other. And the thing that I remember about the fight, like the first fight, was that this was like the true test of whether Ronda Rousey can be a legitimate fighter in this game, like long term.
Yeah.
And like, there were a lot of questions about it. Like, Ronda had all these first round submissions, and, you know, as exciting as they were, people questioned whether they were all flukes. Like, there were literally five in a row and people were like, oh, it's a fluke. And it's like, are you serious, dude? Like, come on. Like, it's like, she's going against world-class fighters like every single time. But like, Tate was the one where people were like, yeah, this is going to be the one where we find out. And guess what? She arm barred her in the first round too. Like it's yeah. not, and it's not like Tate's some sort of scrub. Misha Tate was one of the top fighters in the world at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and here comes Misha doing the thing that she does and, you know, puts her in an arm bar mm-hmm. every time. And yeah. I mean, I think that was like the second arm bar. Like there was one that she tried to do earlier in the first round and yeah. Tate got out of it. And yeah. everybody was like, oh my God, Misha Tate escaped the arm bar. This is it. This is it. She's going to get Ronda. And then Ronda goes ahead and does it towards the end of round one and puts her out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was, I think this fight too was more so than, you know, elevating women's MMA, because it did great things for women's MMA, but it like, that was the one that legitimized Ronda Rousey. Mm-hmm. Like there was definite bad blood, genuine bad blood. There was a question of whether she was legit and Tate was the answer. And then she went in against Tate and she beat her. Okay. So it was every, like she played it perfectly. She went in against all odds, beat the one who was supposed to beat her and became the baddest woman on the planet, bar none.
Yeah. And then later in the UFC, you know, what an incredible moment when they rematched and Tate takes her into the third round, right?
Yeah.
And holy cow. And then Ronda taps her out again. Yeah. And remember Misha tried to shake her hand and Ronda looked at her and turned yep. the other way. Do you remember that? Like, holy yeah. cow. Like this was, that was incredible. And that was like, that feud, that moment was birthed yeah. in Strikeforce, you know?
Yeah. 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 And it was like, there was the bad blood. Like after a fight, these guys usually come together and say, I just want to give all my respect to my opponent. It's all love, man. And they hug each other and they kiss each other after the fight. But Rousey's like, nah, I hate her. I'm like, all right, cool. Like, fine. We're going to hate. That's cool. Like, I can't wait for part three. But part three never happened, of course, but you know, and yeah, like that, the rematch, they were talking about how, you know, is Ronda good past round one, you right. know, like, and so she took her into round three and of course beat her again, you know, right. like she was great. She was fun to watch, fun to talk to. I totally credit her a lot for like the rise in women's MMA and its transition to the UFC. I think Dana White said something like Rousey and Tate was the reason why he was finally sold on the whole deal and female mixed martial arts. So yeah, that's like great impact, huge impact. And like, I will always celebrate the times having watched her fight and remember it with knowing that like, she was the reason why the sport has become so big for women across the world.
Absolutely. And just one quick note, when she joined the WWE, like no joke, she was like the best women's like pro wrestler on the planet yeah. after match one. I mean, she is so athletic. She was like when Kurt Angle came over and became a pro wrestler. And it was like, how did this guy learn the specifics of this art and this genre and this theater and this athleticism so well?
I'll
so
tell quickly? You why.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. And It starts with Michael Jordan. MJ had this work ethic that was legendary. Mm-hmm. Like he would spend all the time in the gym. He would hold everybody accountable and he was an absolute jerk about it. He didn't care. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to win and he wanted to be the best. This trickled down to other athletes. Kobe Bryant, for example, followed the same suit. Like people thought he was a jerk for years. And ultimately we discovered he was just, his work ethic was just on another level. Mm-hmm. Ronda Rousey had that same work ethic. Mm-hmm. Like she, when she was putting in work, she was trying her damnedest. Mind you, she didn't always do it the best when it came time to perform. For example, her striking wasn't great. Like her technique wasn't all that great, but she definitely did put in the work to try to improve it.
Yeah.
And she was relentless about it. She wanted to be the best. And I think a lot of that has to do with being an Olympic athlete like Kurt Angle. Like they sit there and they analyze themselves like nobody else does. Like everybody has critics. They are their own biggest critic or worst critic. And they analyze and scrutinize everything that they do. And I think the same thing happened when she was going to the WWE. She looked at how to be a successful professional wrestler and just went full Doogie Howser mode with it and like tried to do things like at a very young age within the sport and do great things. And she did, you know, and like, it's that kind of mentality you have to have, especially in professional sports where you're playing or fighting the best athletes in your sport. So you have to have some sort of edge that's better than them. So Rousey has Jordan theory. She scrutinized everything down to the last morsel and tried to improve on it. Again, not necessarily the best at it, i.e. her striking.
Yeah.
But she put in the work to try to make all the potential that she could gain.
Yeah, yeah. And she did get better at striking too, from where she was to where she ended.
Beginning to end, it was like, it was night and day. But ultimately, like, there were better strikers than her. And like, she like literally faced that head on and, you know, lost. But she did put in the work to become a better fighter from the beginning of her career to the very end.
Exactly. Hey, I want to ask you two more questions before we wrap up. This has been like such a good conversation. But the presentation of Strikeforce, one of the things for me, whenever I think about Strikeforce, I think of Mauro Ranallo. I think of Frank Shamrock. They had different third individuals, you know, from time to time, Stephen Quadros and Gus Johnson, and Pat Miletic, and just different. But I just think of the commentary at Strikeforce to me is always being really, really a combination of just super high level, but also just like really gritty, like really, really much understanding the sport without hyperbole, without over exaggerating the moment. What do you recall about Strikeforce where, you know, at this time we're looking at, you know, Joe Rogan and Mike Goldberg, and they're kind of the brand, but over at Strikeforce, I felt like Mauro Ranallo, I felt like Frank Shamrock, they were legit. Like they were so good. And I thought they were a better team than the UFC team. What are your thoughts on that presentation of the sport with those guys?
I enjoyed Strikeforce's presentation. I think the broadcast crew was great, but one cannot talk about Strikeforce's broadcasts without Gus Johnson's. Sometimes these things happen in MMA.
Yeah.
Okay. We need to touch on that. Yeah. So Gus Johnson, great college football guy, you know, incredibly professional play-by-play announcing guy. Like he was great. And then they stuck him on mixed martial arts for the first time. And it happened at the absolute worst time with Strikeforce in Nashville. And so Jake Shields is getting interviewed. Jason Mayhem Miller comes up, "What are you going to give me mine, bro?" And like Jake Shields and Melendez and everybody were like starting to throw, and like Gus Johnson still had the mic. He's like, gentlemen, we're on national television. Sometimes these things happen in MMA. Gentlemen. So it was an all-time blunder for Gus Johnson.
Yeah.
He's not going to be remembered for that. He's going to be remembered for the great play-by-play that he's done for other sports. So kudos to him for that.
How would you have handled that, Eric? Like, how would you, if you're Gus in that moment, how do you handle that better?
Okay. So if there's a fight breaking out, it's not the reporter or sideline guy's responsibility to play referee.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So you put the mic down, you get out of the cage, period.
Right.
Okay. You don't try to save, you know, your strikes from the FCC. You don't try to prevent a fight from happening. Gus Johnson is not a mixed martial artist. Like, he's not going to get in between Jason Miller and Jake Shields and be successful. You just put the mic down and you get out, and you let, you know, the powers that be come in and try to separate them, which they did. So there was absolutely no need for Gus Johnson to get on the mic and say what he said. But he said it. So, and we can't do anything about it, but that's always going to be an all time funny thing for me in MMA.
Oh my goodness.
Gus Johnson, gentlemen, sometimes these things happen in MMA.
Yeah, what a dumb line. Yeah, and that was sort of the big fall for Strikeforce, because they lost their CBS contract after that.
They did. And, you know, I mean, ultimately, I don't think, you know, losing CBS was one thing, but just they needed to keep doing what they were doing, and they did. And the UFC took notice. Right. And looked at them as a threat, regardless of their CBS contract. And I think one of the things that you wanted to touch on was, you know, the broadcast team with Mauro Ranallo.
Yeah.
Mauro was great. Yeah. Mauro was absolutely great. I went on his podcast one time. He invited me on to talk about, you know, mixed martial arts. I don't even remember the topics, other than me telling Mauro, like, hey, you know what? I appreciate you bringing me on, because I loved hearing you in Pride.
Yeah.
Pride, like Mauro Ranallo's play-by-play in Pride really sold those fights. Yeah. And the fact that Strikeforce brought him over to do the play-by-play made Strikeforce broadcast that much better.
Yeah.
The Mauro's, "You see him! You see him!" Like his completely over-the-top announcing was just great for the mayhem that was occurring on screen. It was wonderful. And he has, you know, he has this voice that makes you think what you're watching is important. You know, yeah. He has this like very, he could be monotone at times where he's like, "Fedor Emelianenko," you know, and it just captures you. It's at the right tone. It's at the right pace to where it captures you and makes you want to listen. And then he brilliantly illustrated what was going on in front of you vocally. Like it was wonderful to hear. And I think he was always a professional when it came to things, you know, and always like anytime there's a fight and Mauro Ranallo is doing the play-by-play, that's something I could watch.
Right.
Like if they put Mauro on UFC broadcasts, that would be outstanding.
Right.
That would be wonderful. Like I always enjoyed Joe Rogan and what's his name? The guy that they got rid of. I forget his name.
Goldberg.
Yeah. Mike Goldberg.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate all the things they did, you know, for years. But if they brought Mauro Ranallo into the UFC, that would potentially make me want to watch again. Just because he was able to make the broadcasts entertaining. Like, could you imagine Mauro Ranallo and Daniel Cormier? there would be even more memes with those two. Yeah, like totally. I wouldn't be able to get enough. I'd probably watch it just to try to make memes out of Mauro Ranallo sound bites. Like that was it. But you know, he's absolutely great when it comes to combat sports. Like such a pro, great delivery, and he makes the fights that much more interesting to watch.
Yeah, my favorite Strikeforce moment was when Scott Smith came back after getting hammered by Kung Lee for two straight rounds, getting kicked to death, you know, in the ribs and the face and the head. And then Kung got tired and Scott Smith hit him and, you know, it was over. And then he finished him and Mauro Ranallo is just going nuts. And he's like,
"Yes,
miracle in San Jose." It was such a, you know, like just making Scott Smith, like in that moment, sound like Rocky, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had a stretch there. Scott Smith had a stretch there where they were thinking he was like the comeback MMA fighter of the decade.
Yeah.
Like he was doing great things. He was beating all these guys. They're like, "Middleweight champ for sure." And I think he did try at the middleweight belt in Strikeforce, and then he came up short. Like Scott Smith was just a tough guy. Yes. Yeah. He met Paul Daly. He was tough. Like he was probably one of the toughest guys in the sport at the time. Yeah. Like, and that's the thing that really, really set him apart. But like, yeah, as far as like polished, well-skilled fighter, not so much, but it will hit you really hard.
Yeah. So before we wrap up here, can you just, you know, we've talked about it in so many places here so far, but can you just talk about what Strikeforce's long-lasting contributions to the current state of MMA were? What is Strikeforce's legacy? I don't want to crap on Bellator. Scott Coker obviously is involved there. But, you know, Bellator doesn't have, to me, in my perspective, the the hardcore fan following that Strikeforce did. Bellator is like a TV product that people mm-hmm. will check it out. But Strikeforce had this sort of like energy behind it, and it was real and it was authentic. And even today, you come across people in the sport who remember Strikeforce fondly. What is your take? What is Strikeforce's legacy?
Strikeforce's legacy is the reason that they're the reason why you're watching people like Amanda Nunes fall to the Venezuelan Vixen.
Yeah.
They are responsible for bringing women's mixed martial arts on to the grandest stage. I think Elite XC did some great things there, but it was really Strikeforce that lifted it up in that time. Additionally, they had that, like when Pride closed down, a lot of Pride fighters came to Strikeforce. And for the first time, people in the US were watching what these Japanese guys did. And all of the great talent that came from there. You know, they brought Fedor to the US soil on a long-term basis. You know, and that was fun to watch. And it was a great alternative to what the UFC was doing. Like, for a time, like, all you got was UFC. All you got was UFC, and which is fine. But then all of a sudden, you see this other organization putting on these fights. And you see this big roided out dude in Alistair Overeem. You know, you see it, you know, like Fedor almost lose to, what's his name? I forget the...
Brett Rogers.
Brett Rogers. Yeah. You know, he's like, I remember watching the lead up to that fight and thinking, oh man, Rogers looks like he's going to kill him. And then for the first part of that fight, like he was, and then suddenly Fedor just throws this like right-handed haymaker and Rogers just collapses. And and you know, these were all Strikeforce memories. So like, it's nice to know that, you know, we had these kind of fights and this big extravaganza with Moro on the mic. And you know, like, those are all great things. Like, MMA would not be where it is today without Strikeforce, hands down. Like, there's female bantamweight champs because of Strikeforce.
Yeah.
And the lower weight divisions don't happen without bantamweight coming into the UFC. Yeah. But bantamweight doesn't get into the UFC without Strikeforce.
Yeah.
So that's the long lasting legacy.
All right. Well put, Eric. I really appreciate your time. And for those of you who, you know, maybe you don't know who Eric is, go Google his stories. I mean, I'm thinking about it here in the last 45 minutes here where we've been talking. You just had so many scoops, you know. I remember that now. You know, you were breaking news. And, you know, we're talking about Strikeforce's legacy, but Eric, you had a great legacy of your own in terms of your contributions to MMA journalism. And I'm glad you're over it now. You're doing other stuff, bigger and better stuff. But I think we'll always, you know, remember you for being a legit journalist trying to bring legit journalism to a sport that didn't always and doesn't always welcome it. So thanks a lot, Eric, for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Josh, you're too kind, and I appreciate it so much more, man. Thanks.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dino Tripodis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dino Tripodis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.